Chapter 7. Chattered loudly in the big kitchen, unrebuked, from morning to night. He said to himself, we must change all this. He talked the matter over with his father one evening, when the rays of the setting sun entering the yard between the outhouses, ruled the heavy shadows with luminous streaks. Over the manure heap floated a mist, opal-tinted and odorous, and the marauding hens would stop in their scratching, to examine with a sudden glance of their round eye the two men, both lean and tall, talking in hoarse tones. The old man, all twisted with rheumatism and bowed with years of work, the younger bony and straight, spoke without gestures in the indifferent manner of peasants, grave and slow. But before the sun had set, the father had submitted to the sensible arguments of the son. It is not for me that I am speaking, insisted Jean-Pierre. It is for the land. It's a pity to see it badly used. I am not impatient for myself. The old fellow nodded over his stick. I dare say, he muttered. You may be right. Do what you like. It's the mother that will be pleased. The mother was pleased with her daughter-in-law. Jean-Pierre brought the two-wheeled spring cart with a rush into the yard. The gray horse galloped clumsily, and the bride and bridegroom, sitting side by side, were jerked backwards and forwards by the up and down motion of the shafts, in a manner regular and brusque. On the road the distanced wedding guests straggled in pairs and groups. The men advanced with heavy steps, swinging their idle arms. They were clad in town clothes, jackets cut with clumsy smartness, hard black hats, immense boots, polished highly. Their women all in simple black, with white caps and shawls of faded tints folded triangularly on the back, strolled lightly by their side. In front the violin sang a strident tune, and the biniou snored and hummed, while the player capered solemnly, lifting high his heavy clogs. The somber procession drifted in, and out of the narrow lanes, through sunshine and through shade, between fields and hedgerows, scaring the little birds that darted away in troops right and left. In the yard of Bacadou's farm the dark ribbon wound itself up into a mass of men and women pushing at the door with cries and greetings. The wedding dinner was remembered for months. It was a splendid feast in the orchard. Farmers of considerable means and excellent repute were to be found sleeping in ditches all along the road to Tregeur, even as late as the afternoon of the next day. All the countryside participated in the happiness of Jean-Pierre. He remained sober and, together with his quiet wife, kept out of the way, letting father and mother reap their due of honor and thanks. But the next day he took hold strongly, and the old folks felt a shadow precursor of the grave fall upon them finally. The world is to the young. When the twins were born there was plenty of room in the house, for the mother of Jean-Pierre had gone away, to dwell under a heavy stone in the cemetery of Plaumur. On that day, for the first time since his son's marriage, the elder Bacadou, neglected by the cackling lot of strange women who thronged the kitchen, left in the morning his seat under the mantle of the fireplace, and went into the empty cowhouse, shaking his white locks dismally. Grandsons were all very well, but he wanted his soup at midday. When shown the babies, he stared at them with a fixed gaze, and muttered something like, it's too much. Whether he meant too much happiness, or simply commented upon the number of his descendants, it is impossible to say. He looked offended as far as his old wooden face could express anything, and for days afterwards could be seen, almost any time of the day, sitting at the gate, with his nose over his knees, a pipe between his gums, and gathered up into a kind of raging concentrated sulkiness. Once he spoke to his son, alluding to the newcomers with a groan, they will quarrel over the land. Don't bother about that, father, answered Jean-Pierre, stolidly, and passed, bent double, towing a recalcitrant cow over his shoulder. He was happy, and so was Susan, his wife. It was not an ethereal joy welcoming new souls to struggle, perchance to victory. In 14 years both boys would be a help, and, later on, Jean-Pierre pictured two big sons striding over the land from patch to patch, bringing tribute from the earth beloved and fruitful. Susan was happy too, for she did not want to be spoken of as the unfortunate woman, and now she had children no one could call her that. Both herself and her husband had seen something of the larger world during the time of his service. Wallace, he had spent a year or so in Paris with a Breton family, but had been too homesick to remain longer away from the hilly and green country, set in a barren circle of rocks and sands, whereas he had been born. She thought that one of the boys ought perhaps to be a priest, but said nothing to her husband, who was a Republican, and hated the Rose, as he called the ministers of religion. The christening was a splendid affair. All the commune came to it, for the Bacchettes were rich and influential, and, now and then, did not mind the expense. The grandfather had a new coat. Some months afterwards, one evening when the kitchen had been swept, and the door locked, Jean-Pierre, looking at the cot, asked his wife, "What's the matter with those children?" And, as if these words, spoken calmly, had been the portent of misfortune, she answered with a loud wail that must have been heard across the yard in the pigsty, for the pigs, the Bacchettes had the finest pigs in the country, stirred and grunted complainingly in the night. The husband went on grinding his bread and butter slowly, gazing at the wall, the soup plate smoking under his chin. He had returned late from the market, where he had overheard, not for the first time, whispers behind his back. He revolved the words in his mind as he drove back. "S simple. Both of them. Dot 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 never any use. Dot 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 well. Maybe, maybe. One must see." Would ask his wife. This was her answer. He felt like a blow on his chest, but said only, "Colon go, draw me some cider. I am thirsty." She went out moaning, an empty jug in her hand. Then he arose, took up the light, and moved slowly towards the cradle. They slept. He looked at them sideways, finished his mouthful there, went back heavily, and sat down before his plate. When his wife returned, he never looked up, but swallowed a couple of spoonfuls noisily, and remarked, in a dull manner, "When they sleep, they are like other people's children." She sat down suddenly on a stool nearby, and shook with a silent tempest of sobs, unable to speak. He finished his meal, and remained idly thrown back in his chair, his eyes lost amongst the black rafters of the ceiling. Before him the tallow candle flared red and straight, sending up a slender thread of smoke. The light lay on the rough, sunburnt skin of his throat. The sunk cheeks were like patches of darkness, and his aspect was mournfully stolid, as if he had ruminated with difficulty endless ideas. Then he said, deliberately, "We must see. Dot dot consult people. Don't cry. Dot 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 they won't all be like that. Dot dot surely. We must sleep now." After the third child, also a boy, was born, Jean-Pierre went about his work with tense hopefulness. His lips seemed more narrow, more tightly compressed than before, as if for fear of letting the earth he tilled hear the voice of hope that murmured within his breast. He watched the child, stepping up to the cot with a heavy clang of sabots on the stone floor, and glanced in, along his shoulder, with that indifference which is like a deformity of peasant humanity. Like the earth they master and serve, those men, slow of eye and speech, do not show the inner fire, so that, at last, it becomes a question with them, as with the earth, what there is in the core. Heat, violence, a force mysterious and terrible, or nothing but a clod, a mass fertile and inert, cold and unfeeling, ready to bear a crop of plants that sustain life or give death. The mother watched with other eyes, listened with otherwise expectant ears. Under the high-hanging shelves supporting great sides of bacon overhead, her body was busy by the great fireplace, attentive to the pot swinging on iron gallows, scrubbing the long table, where the field hands would sit down directly to their evening meal. Her mind remained by the cradle, night and day on the watch, to hope and suffer. That child, like the other two, never smiled, never stretched its hands to her, never spoke, never had a glance of recognition for her in its big black eyes, which could only stare fixedly at any glitter, but failed hopelessly to follow the brilliance of a sun ray slipping slowly along the floor. When the men were at work, she spent long days between her three idiot children and the childish grandfather, who sat grim, angular, and immovable, with his feet near the warm ashes of the fire. The feeble old fellow seemed to suspect that there was something wrong with his grandsons. Only once, moved either by affection or by the sense of proprieties, he attempted to nurse the youngest. He took the boy up from the floor, clicked his tongue at him, and essayed a shaky gallop of his bony knees. Then he looked closely with his misty eyes at the child's face, and deposited him down gently on the floor again. And he sat, his lean shanks crossed, nodding at the steam escaping from the cooking pot with a gaze senile and worried. Then mute affliction dwelt in Bacadou's farmhouse, sharing the breath and the bread of its inhabitants. And the priest of the Plowmer parish had great cause for congratulation. He called upon the rich landowner, the Marquis de Chavannes, on purpose to deliver himself with joyful unction of solemn platitudes about the inscrutable ways of Providence. In the vast dimness of the curtained drawing room, the little man, resembling a black bolster, leaned towards a couch, his hat on his knees, and gesticulated with a fat hand at the elongated, gracefully flowing lines of the clear Parisian toilet from which the half-amused, half-bored Marquise listened with gracious languor. He was exulting and humble, proud and awed. The impossible had come to pass. Jean-Pierre Bacadou, the enraged Republican farmer, had been to Mass last Sunday and proposed to entertain the visiting priests at the next festival of Plowmer. It was a triumph for the church, and for the good cause. I thought I would come at once, to tell Monsieur le Marquis. I know how anxious he is for the welfare of our country, declared the priest, wiping his face. He was asked to stay to dinner. The Chavannes returning that evening, after seeing their guest to the main gate of the park, discussed the matter, while they strolled in the moonlight, trailing their long shadows up the straight avenue of chestnuts. The Marquise, a royalist of course, had been mayor of the commune which includes Plowmer, the scattered hamlets of the coast, and the stony islands that fringe the yellow flatness of the sands. He had felt his position insecure, for there was a strong Republican element in that part of the country, but now the conversion of Jean-Pierre made him safe. He was very pleased. You have no idea how influential those people are, he explained to his wife. And now, I am sure, the next communal election will go all right. I shall be re-elected. Why, your ambition is perfectly insatiable, Charles, exclaimed the Marquise, gaily. But, ma chère mi, argued the husband, seriously, it's most important that the right man should be mayor this year, because of the elections to the chamber. If you think it amuses me. Jean-Pierre had surrendered to his wife's mother. Madame Levaille was a woman of business, known and respected within a radius of at least 15 miles. Thick-set and stout, she was seen about the country, on foot or in an acquaintance's cart, perpetually moving, in spite of her 58 years, in steady pursuit of business. As he had houses in all the hamlets, she worked quarries of granite, she freighted coasters with stone, even traded with the Channel Islands. She was broad-cheeked, wide-eyed, persuasive in speech, carrying her point with the placid and invincible obstinacy of an old woman who knows her own mind. She very seldom slept for two nights together in the same house, and the wayside inns were the best places to inquire in as to her whereabouts. As he had either passed, or was expected to pass there at 6, or somebody, coming in, had seen her in the morning, or expected to meet her that evening. After the inns that command the roads, the churches were the buildings she frequented most. Men of liberal opinions would induce small children to run into sacred edifices to see whether Madame Levaille was there, and to tell her that so-and-so was in the road waiting, to speak to her about potatoes, her flour, her stones, her houses, and she would curtail her devotions, come out blinking and crossing herself into the sunshine, ready to discuss business matters in a calm, sensible way across a table in the kitchen of the inn opposite. Latterly, as he had stayed for a few days several times with her son-in-law, arguing against sorrow and misfortune with composed face and gentle tones. Jean-Pierre felt the convictions imbibed in the regiment torn out of his breast, not by arguments but by facts. Striding over his fields, he thought it over. There were three of them. Three. All alike. Why? Such things did not happen to everybody, to nobody he ever heard of. One might pass. But three. All three. Forever useless, to be fed while he lived and... What would become of the land when he died? This must be seen to. He would sacrifice his convictions. One day he told his wife, "See what your God will do for us. Pay for some masses." Susan embraced her man. He stood unbending, then turned on his heels and went out. But afterwards, when a black sultan darkened his doorway, he did not object, even offered some cider himself to the priest. He listened to the talk meekly, went to mass between the two women, accomplished what the priest called his religious duties at Easter. That morning he felt like a man who had sold his soul. In the afternoon he fought ferociously with an old friend and neighbor who had remarked that the priests had the best of it, and were now going to eat the priest-eater. He came home disheveled and bleeding, and happening to catch sight of his children, they were kept generally out of the way, cursed and swore incoherently, banging the table. Susan wept. Madame Lavelle sat serenely unmoved. She assured her daughter that tea will pass, and taking up her thick umbrella, departed in haste to see after a schooner she was going to load with granite from her quarry. A year or so afterwards the girl was born. A girl. Jean-Pierre heard of it in the fields, and was so upset by the news, that he sat down on the boundary wall, and remained there till the evening, instead of going home as he was urged to do. A girl. He felt half cheated. However, when he got home he was partly reconciled to his fate. One could marry her to a good fellow, not to a good for nothing, but to a fellow with some understanding, and a good pair of arms. Besides, the next may be a boy, he thought. Of course they would be all right. His new credulity knew of no doubt. The ill luck was broken. He spoke cheerily to his wife. She was also hopeful. Three priests came to that christening, and Madame Lavelle was godmother. The child turned out an idiot too. Then on market days Jean-Pierre was seen bargaining bitterly, quarrelsome and greedy, then getting drunk with taciturn earnestness, then driving home in the dusk at a rate fit for a wedding, but with a face gloomy enough for a funeral. Sometimes he would insist on his wife coming with him, and they would drive in the early morning, shaking side by side on the narrow seat above the helpless pig, that, with tied legs, grunted a melancholy sigh at every rut. The morning drives were silent, but in the evening, coming home, Jean-Pierre, tipsy, was viciously muttering, and growled at the confounded woman who could not rear children that were like anybody else's. Susan, holding on against the erratic swayings of the cart, pretended not to hear. Once, as they were driving through Plumer, some obscure and drunken impulse caused him to pull up sharply opposite the church. The moon swam amongst light white clouds. The tombstones gleamed pale under the fretted shadows of the trees in the churchyard. Even the village dog slept. Only the nightingales, awake, spun out the thrill of their song above the silence of graves. Jean-Pierre said thickly to his wife, "What do you think is there?" He pointed his whip at the tower in which the big dial of the clock appeared high in the moonlight like a pallid face without eyes, and getting out carefully, fell down at once by the wheel. He picked himself up and climbed one by one the few steps to the iron gate of the churchyard. He put his face to the bars, and called out indistinctly, "Hey there! Come out! John! Return! Return!" entreated his wife in low tones. He took no notice, and seemed to wait there. The song of nightingales beat on all sides against the high walls of the church, and flowed back between stone crosses and flat gray slabs, engraved with words of hope and sorrow. "Hey! Come out!" shouted Jean-Pierre, loudly. The nightingales ceased to sing. "Nobody?" went on Jean-Pierre. "Nobody there. A swindle of the crows. That's what this is. Nobody anywhere. I despise it. Alice. Hoop." He shook the gate with all his strength, and the iron bars rattled with a frightful clanging, like a chain dragged over stone steps. A dog nearby barked hurriedly. Jean-Pierre staggered back, and after three successive dashes got into his cart. Susan sat very quiet and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.